Coming up on Weekend America.
This weekend, controversial statements from a black American preacher.
And I come by here to say that America, too, is going to hell if she doesn't use her wealth.
A new documentary explores MLK's final year of life. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. What if your uncle told you your favorite family stories were exaggerations?
I was very upset. I felt betrayed. And he said, you know, Annie, your family is as defined by the stories that aren't true as by the stories that are.
We've got some great stories for you. Just don't hold us to them. And for this naturalist, springtime means paint.
And so what you have is this male sitting on the ground, and it's giving this repeated call that's usually described as peent. It's this very mechanical, nasal, frog-like sound.
Listen to The Weeknd after the news.
Weeknd America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weeknd. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. Let's say you have a box of memories, some of them unhappy memories, but they're yours. Do you keep the box? Renounce the box? Yes, it's a metaphor and a literal box that John Moe is dealing with. We'll take you into his world later this hour. In the meantime, on this March 29th, tell us, what does spring mean to you?
Spring means spring break. Time to get out of school and stop learning and go to the beach and have fun.
Spring signals to me that it is time for baseball season.
I think spring signals the beginning of fishing season to me.
I like the way spring smells.
I like how friendly and excited to live everyone is again after so many long, cold months.
Spring smells like wet dirt and living things, and it gives me hope that there will be green out on the lawn instead of snow.
Seems like spring brings out the poet in everybody.
Doesn't it? Those voices came to us from Boston, Chicago, New Orleans, San Francisco, and Ann Arbor.
Friday is the 40th anniversary of Martin Luther King's death. We tend to think of him as a peaceful optimist who dreamed of a better America in 1963. But in the year before he died, King had a different reputation. He took on the Vietnam War, alienating both the public and President Johnson. In response, the FBI wiretapped King, fanned rumors of his affairs, and linked him to communists. Undeterred, King launched what may have been the most ambitious mission of his life, the end of poverty. This weekend, American Radio Works debuts a documentary called King's Last March. It explores his tortured final year. Producer Kate Ellis will join us in a minute, but first, let's listen to one of King's early speeches protesting the Vietnam War.
I talked in Washington in 1963 about my dream, and we stood there in those high moments with high hopes. And over and over again, I've seen this dream turn into a nightmare. I've seen promising young black boys who are already facing discrimination at home, going away and dying in disproportionate numbers in Vietnam. We are 11% of the population here, and we are 22 4/10% of the dying force in Vietnam. These are facts that we must hear. When somebody tells me that these two issues can't be mixed, they are mixed. I didn't mix them. The war mixed them. Our nation spends approximately $500,000 to kill every enemy soldier. And we spend about $53 a year on every person categorized as poverty-stricken, and half of this goes for the salaries of those who are not poor.
Kate, listening to that, one wonders why he felt so compelled to go from racial equity into the issue of peace and poverty.
Well, as he says in this, and he said this many times, they are not separate issues. King and Johnson had been allies in the fight against poverty, been allies in trying to get really important civil rights legislation passed. But as the war in Vietnam escalated, King really did feel like, you know, as he said, that his dream was turning into a nightmare because all of the country's money, essentially, and the priorities were going toward fighting what he considered an unjust war in Vietnam. I think his feeling was, how could you not see the ways that these are connected?
So what did happen when he started to make this public stand?
Well, the press went after him immediately, and the mainstream press, you know, the New York Times, you know, practically called him a traitor. Mainstream civil rights organizations like the NAACP and the Urban League also criticized him for hurting his cause, civil rights, thought he was making a grave tactical error by coming out against the war.
And he started to suffer personally because of this reaction. Let's hear another cut from one of his speeches.
He may not have realized all of his dreams, but he tried. Yes. Isn't that a wonderful thing for somebody to say about you? He tried to be a good man. He tried to be a just man. He tried to be an honest man. His heart was in the right place. You don't need to go out this morning saying that Martin Luther King is a saint. Oh, no. I want you to know this morning that I'm a sinner like all of God's children, but I want to be a good man. And I want to hear a voice saying to me one day, I take you in and I bless you because you try.
Kate, what does this speech reveal about King and his mindset in that moment?
He gave that sermon at his home church, Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, exactly 1 month before he died. And in that time, he was really struggling with depression and exhaustion and incredible self-doubt. In the last year of his life, he was really taking on the issue of poverty. I mean, he was calling for an end to poverty. And I think in his darkest moments, he had to acknowledge to himself that he might fail. And King often used his sermons to comfort himself as well as his congregation. And I think that this is a good example where he is helping to preach himself through his own self-doubts and saying, ultimately, I hope and I believe that God is going to judge me well for having tried.
And he did continue to try. In the last month of his life, he felt drawn to Memphis. Can you talk a bit about that?
What he was doing in the winter of 1968, he was organizing what's called a Poor People's Campaign. And they were going to have this massive march to Washington where people from all over the country, from many different backgrounds, Appalachian whites, poor Indians, you know, people coming from all over the country were going to come to Washington and they were going to stay. They were going to camp out, build a shanty town, and kind of shut down the city through peaceful, nonviolent civil disobedience. So that's what he was in the middle of organizing. It was an incredibly audacious, ambitious undertaking. And so the organization was stretched really thin when King got a call from a close friend and ally in the, you know, civil rights movement saying, you know, there are these sanitation workers who are striking in Memphis and we could really use your help. It's been going on for a while now. We're not getting anywhere. We could really use you. Just come and make a speech.
So let's hear a clip from that. That's just 2 weeks before he was murdered.
And I come by here to say that America, too, is going to hell if she doesn't use her wealth.
That's right.
America does not use her vast resources of wealth to end poverty. Make it possible for all of God's children to have the basic necessities of life. She too will go to hell.
What strikes you about this speech?
Well, that his words for America are very strong. You know, to say America's going to go to hell if she doesn't use her wealth to help the poor, that's a pretty strong criticism.
And it's eerie. There is an eerie comparison to the sound bites we've been hearing more recently from Reverend Jeremiah Wright, Barack Obama's minister.
At the same time, King was always careful to say, you know, I love America. And America, I love you so much then I'm going to tell you when you're wrong. And so in some ways, I would have to compare him a little bit more to Barack Obama, in that Obama's saying, you know, we're not perfect, but we can be perfected. And I actually think that that's actually a closer connection to King's message, in a sense, than some of what I've heard Reverend Wright say.
Now, let's listen to a little bit more of the speech. And it does seem, as pointed out in the documentary, that an idea occurs to him right in the middle of the speech. Let's hear some of that.
I tell you what you ought to do, and you're together here enough to do it. In a few days, you ought to get together and just have a general work stoppage in the city of Memphis.
What happened after that speech?
Well, he promised to return to lead a march for them, and he did 10 days later. That march turned violent. It was the first march King had ever led that turned violent and was basically a disaster for King. And so King vowed to return just a few days later to actually lead a peaceful march. He just felt he needed to do that to prove that he could still control a march, especially when he had the Poor People's Campaign coming up. He returned on April 3rd, gave a big speech that night called I've Been to the Mountaintop, where he actually talked about the possibility of dying and that it, you know, and said, I may not get there with you, but we will get to the promised land. And the next day, he was assassinated at the Lorraine Motel.
What does it mean to you that he was killed in that moment?
I don't think it makes so much difference whether he was at a low point or a high point in his career. It was that he wouldn't stop no matter what. And he was shot down in the middle of taking on yet an even greater challenge.
Was it hard to live with him for a year, to have his words and his voice in your ear and then have him die?
Yeah. Yep. I'm really sad. I'm sad. I mean, it sort of sounds funny because it's been 40 years.
Well, Kate, I want to thank you for bringing this particular story about King to light.
You are welcome.
American Public Media's American Radio Works produced the documentary King's Last March. If you go to our website at weekinamerica.org, you can find links to the entire documentary. And there's also links to King's speeches and videos of him in his last year.
Yeah, the documentary site takes you back to those final days, the events leading to his last speech. There is a slideshow of King's open casket funeral, the memorial march, grown men weeping, hard to watch, but it takes you there.
Relive history with us at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by MassMutual, also the proud sponsor of Retirement Revolution on PBS. Host Paula Zahn joins economists, authors, and financial professionals for Retirement Revolution, Monday, March 31st at 10 p.m. Eastern.
Coming up, you were supposed to be on that plane with Buddy Holly, but you gave up your seat. Why are you lying? That's next on Weekend America.
This is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. Picture this. You're having Sunday brunch with friends, and your partner or your buddy launches into a story, and you've heard it before. You know where it's going. This person loves to tell this story, but you're cringing because you know that the way they're telling it is not the way it actually happened. Senator Hillary Clinton has gotten into trouble for telling reporters about her 1996 landing in Bosnia when she ran with her head down under sniper fire and then later admitting that it didn't really go like that. Now, you might have an opinion about why Clinton told the story the way she did. People exaggerate stories, lie about stories, and just misremember them. With that in mind, we take you now to Des Moines, Iowa, where Larry Lamer realized how elusive the truth of a story can be. Larry was researching his book, The Day the Music Died, the last tour of Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper, and Ritchie Valens.
What I was looking for were people who were at the shows on that last tour, people who might have had some contact with the singer, people who were on the bus, that sort of thing. I was trying to get as close to the story as I could. And almost everybody who was on that tour has told a story at some time or another how they had a seat on that plane and they gave it up at the last minute, which, of course, is only true of a couple of people. When I interviewed Waylon Jennings for the book, it was he kind of carried some guilt with him for a long time because he had given up his seat to the Big Bopper. And there were so many people that claimed that they had given up that seat on that plane, which is a four-seat plane. Obviously, not everybody could have fit on it. That he says that if everyone was on that plane that said they were supposed to be on that plane, they'd have needed a 747.
A long time forgotten, our dreams had just fell by the way. And the good life he promised ain't what she's living today.
I'm Ann Hagman Cardinal, and I live in Morrisville, Vermont, and I'm a fiction writer, a novelist. And when I was a child, my mother would tell me these stories about my family in Puerto Rico. We would be in my great-aunt's house in Puerto Rico in Bayamon, and she said that my great-aunt did not go into the front room because her father had shot himself in that room. And it was a big mystery because there were two bullets, and I believed it. I was actually very freaked out by sleeping next to this room. And then I mentioned this after several years after my mother's death to my uncle, who said, you know, Annie, that house wasn't even built then. He died of TB very slowly, and there was no, he didn't shoot himself. And at first, I was very disillusioned. I was very upset. I felt betrayed. And he said, you know, Annie, your family is as defined by the stories that aren't true as by the stories that are. And I took great comfort in that, and that actually drove a lot of my writing. And that's been sort of my goal of becoming a writer, is to document the stories that my family told, true or not.
It was the spring of 1991, I'd say. We were in a bar on the north side of Chicago. A nice, fun night out, a nice Saturday night. Coming back from the restroom, and I was smoking a cigarette, and I was going back to where my friend and I were sitting, and this girl turns to me, who, you know, she was not, well, she was large enough to make this point, and she turns to me and says, do you have a light? Obviously, because I was smoking, so I would have a lighter on me, and I was like, no, unfortunately, I don't. And as I kept walking back to my table, she's like, well, what are you good for then? And I turned to her and said, you know, it sounds like you swallowed a lot of aggression along with a lot of pizza, which was a line from Stripes. And as I said it, I turned around and kept walking. So, you know, I always thought that was a pretty funny story. So it turns out what really happened was I was walking past her. She said, hey, what are you good for? And I basically, you know, said, you, and kept walking. And so by the time I got back to the table, my friend turned to me and he's like, hey, what's going on with that girl? And I made up this line about eating too much pizza, which would have been the perfect comeback. It would have been rude and downright despicable. But looking back 15 years later, but at the time it would have been pretty funny.
as, you know, time goes on and we start hanging out and we start seeing other friends, and he's like, oh, you should have heard what Raj said. You should have heard what he said. It was great. And so the story kind of took on a bit of a life of its own. So as I went on, you know, went back to work on Monday and told guys, oh, you should have heard what I said to this lady and blah, 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 and this girl at the bar. And it's that old line from Seinfeld. I started to believe the lie. It's no longer a lie when you believe it to be true, which is what George Costanza says.
My version, it was a night unlike any other night for... I believe that she had asked for a light, and Roger said he didn't have one or something else. I can't remember the gist of it, but then she just made some wisecrack comment to Roger. Roger turns to her and said, let me get this straight now. Sounds like you girls have swallowed a lot of aggression, and then paused and added in, along with lots of pizzas. Oh, I was right next to him on his left-hand side. Lucky to be paying attention and heard the whole thing. So, yeah.
I feel it's my favorite part of the story. Oh. It's my favorite part of the story because I never said it to the girl. And the simple fact that Steve has actually clung to this part of the story, and the fact that this lie has taken on a life of its own in Steve's mind.
Wow, I feel like I need like a 12-step program. That was my recollection, yeah.
We were out one night, and this is pretty much after I stopped drinking, and we were out chatting with some friends. You started telling this, oh, listen to this great story about Roger. And then you said it, and I'm like, Steven, it didn't really happen. And then you jumped in like, no, I was right next to you. Don't give me that, you know, that trying to atone for your past type stuff.
Now you're doing the, you're pulling the Roger Clemens on me.
I'm not. You're misremembering.
So Roger, I will just say that the truth will set you free.
Steve, I am free.
That was Roger Sullivan in Dexter, Michigan, and his friend Steve, Ann Hagman Cardinal in Morrisville, Vermont, and Larry Lamer in Des Moines, Iowa.
Why is memory so faulty? We called up Dan Schachter. He's a Harvard professor who studies memory, and he says that if you imagine that something happened, your brain over time will often convince you that it did. He also says that memory is skewed by our biases. What you believe changes what you recall.
Right. And for ways to strengthen your memory, Schachter says there's actually not much evidence to support the crossword puzzle Sudoku method. He says the best way is still to write stuff down. And we have a link to Dan Schachter's book about memory and to that Buddy Holly book at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
You may recall that Prince is crazy about little red Corvettes. But did you know that he's sentimental about April snow? Stories of spring coming up on Weekend America.
This is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. What is the soundtrack to your weekend? When you want to get into a space that's all your own, what song do you keep going back to? We've been asking you that for a while now, and we've gotten all kinds of stories set to all kinds of music. You can make an amazing mixtape by going to weekendamerica.org and hearing our Weekend Soundtracks collection. Our latest story comes from Kim Hirschberger. Kim listens to us in Goshen, Indiana. She told us the soundtrack to her weekend connects her to her sister, Gay. The song is Phil Collins' Against All Odds.
How can I just let you walk away? Just let you leave without a trace? When I stand here taking every breath with you, ooh, you're the only one who really knew me at all. How can you just walk away from me when all I can do is watch you leave?
Kim, why is this song your weekend soundtrack?
Oh, just listen to the yearning in his voice. The first time I heard this song, it pulled me out of the despair of having lost my twin. My twin died when we were only 21 years old in 1981. And I honestly thought that I was dying of heartbreak. And when I first heard the first strains, I thought, oh, that's very pretty. And then I heard Phil say, how can you just walk away from me when all I can do is watch you leave? And I realized, yeah, how could Gay just walk away from me, just leave me alone? And I realized my despair could turn into a little bit of indignation. I could handle that.
I wish I could just make you turn.
What happened to your sister, Gay?
She was driving on an icy road one night on her way to her boyfriend's house. She lost control of the car and went over a bridge, and her car landed upside down, and she drowned. When we had the funeral, and I looked down at her with my face and my body, I didn't think I'd be able to survive it. So when he says, there's just an empty space, and there's nothing left here to remind me, just the memory of your face. That's me. That's looking in the mirror and seeing Gay. And all I've got is the memory of her face, and I see it every time I look in the mirror.
What memories of Gay and you come back?
I remember our last Christmas together, and Gay had given me a beautiful cloth doll, an old-fashioned doll with a brown calico dress on it and brown braids. And I thought, that is such a beautiful, thoughtful present. It's something that I just loved it. I said, that's exactly what I wanted. And she says, I know it was. Oh, I just love thinking about that.
It's been 27 years now, Kim. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I do wish I've never met another surviving twin. And I've always wished that I had somebody who I could talk to that knew how it felt, but I never have. This song is more of a comforting friend.
You can see photos of the twins, Kim and Gay, at our website. There's a slideshow there, a family slideshow with all five sisters in Kim's family. They include another set of identical twins. That's at weekendamerica.org. And be sure to tell us about your own weekend soundtrack. Just fill out the form there online.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul. This weekend, the signs of spring are everywhere. If you live in Camden, South Carolina, you might be marking spring today by going to the Carolina Cup for the steeplechase horse races. Or if you live near Nashville, maybe you're going on a hike to see the wildflowers. Today, we're bringing you three stories that mark the arrival of spring. The first is from Griffin Woodworth. He's getting a PhD in musicology and is working on his dissertation at UCLA. For him, spring was evoked by a song sung by a member of rock and roll's royalty.
One of the songs that I had always loved by Prince was this sort of little-known song from the soundtrack to the movie Under the Cherry Moon called Sometimes It Snows in April.
I used to cry for Tracy 'cause it was my only friend.
The song is this beautiful evocation of loss and of longing for something that has passed, for something that you can't have again, but you're being constantly reminded of it.
I used to cry for Tracy 'cause I want to see him again. Sometimes, sometimes life ain't always the way.
And the song itself is just unbelievably sad.
Sometimes it snows in April. Sometimes I feel so bad, so bad.
And then I had the idea, why don't I move to Minneapolis as a place to write this dissertation, be suffused with the spirit of place, you know, all of these historical places where Prince had been connected to. So I drove back to Minneapolis.
Springtime was always my favorite time of year.
And discovered, this was April that I moved back, discovered that April is still really winter. I realize that, yes, sometimes it snows in April. It is a song about loss and about longing, but it's also just a literal weather report. When is winter going to end? When are we going to get some warm weather? You know, and the answer to that, of course, is, well, it could get warm any time, but, you know, sometimes it does snow in April.
Sometimes I feel so bad, yeah.
Griffin Woodworth is finishing up his dissertation on Prince in Minneapolis. That's one dissertation I'd love to read. Yes. This weekend, he's looking forward to picking up a new cello.
And as April snow drifts, some people across America are searching for that classic sign of spring, the robin. Weekend America listener Amy Drew grew up in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. She remembers one very diligent robin.
I think I had thought that there was only one, that it was sort of like Santa Claus. It's just one very busy robin going everywhere to announce spring. I would see the one robin in our backyard, and then I would go to the playground, and I would see one robin there, and then I might go over to a friend's house, and I'd see one robin there.
And then Amy moved to Florida, where she was greeted with a flock of robins. Eye-opening. Several of you wrote in to tell us about robin sightings, including Rachel Knudsen. She grew up in Heartland, Minnesota, pining for the robin. About 6 years ago, she was working as a hospice worker, and her search for the first robin of spring took on a new meaning.
It was about this time of year, and I normally provided care for him in his bedroom, and this particular day he wished for me to wash his hair, and walking out to the kitchen and standing at the sink exhausted him, and so we had to sit and rest. While we were sitting there and he was catching his breath, we were chatting and discussing the time of year, and he had asked me if I had seen any robins of spring yet. And I had mentioned that I'd been looking, but I hadn't seen any robins yet. And we continued to chat, sitting at the kitchen table, and he was looking out the window, and suddenly his face lit up, and he exclaimed, "I saw a robin! I saw one!" And I thought for a moment that somehow his mind had just made him see something that he really desired to see. And we sat there for a little bit longer, and pretty soon I saw this little robin head pop up behind the neighbor's fence. And then I realized that he truly had seen the first robin of spring, and I felt his joy. I suddenly was struck with the realization that that was the last first robin of spring that he would ever see. And I started thinking about all the last firsts that he'd been conscious of throughout this terminal illness, and also the last lasts, the last Christmas with his family, the last time he would hold his grandchildren. So now whenever I see my first robin of spring, or any robin actually, I always think of him, and I always remember to really truly cherish the moments that we have with our family and friends.
If you're really hungry for spring, if you're really desperate for some sign that winter is not going to last forever, that's when I find myself heading out to a kind of a weedy meadow along the edge of a low bottomland swampy forest, because I know that's where the woodcock are going to be. My name is Scott Weidensall, and I am a natural history writer, and I'm not making any of this up. We're talking about a shorebird that lives in the woods that's about as big as a man's fist, the color and markings of dead leaves. It has these two big bug eyes that are sitting kind of toward the back of the head so that it can actually see better behind it than it can in front of it. But the most remarkable thing about the woodcock is that this silly, dumpy, pudgy little bird in the springtime perform this extraordinary, beautiful, whimsical, and I think for me at least, very moving sky dance. Just after sunset, in fact, just about exactly 12 minutes after sunset, when the light hits a very particular level of foot candles, the male woodcock begin to give this weirdly mechanical, frog-like sound that's usually described as a peent, which is P-E-E-N-T. They peent for a while, and then they launch themselves into the air, and then when it reaches the apogee of its flight, it will suddenly stop flying, and it's almost as if the bird's been shot, and it begins to tumble to the ground, falling from side to side like a falling leaf and giving this wonderful musical gurgle. And then just before it pancakes on the ground, it catches itself, comes to a landing, and begins to peent again. And you've got sometimes dozens of male woodcock all doing this scattered around the singing grounds. It's basically a singles bar for woodcock. I think one of the things about spring is the ephemeral aspect of it. You know, the woodcock display, for example, only goes on for about a month. You know, if you miss it, you've missed it. It's not going to happen in July. It's not going to happen in August. And so the changing seasons forces you to pay attention, to be a closer observer, to appreciate what you have in front of you at that moment, because it's not going to be there in a very short while.
That's bird enthusiast and natural history writer Scott Weidensall.
As we celebrate the change of seasons, we're also getting ready for the cruelest month. That would be April, National Poetry Month. Shakespeare, Dickinson, Eliot, they all wrote poems dedicated to springtime. The Japanese poet Matsuo Basho wrote this haiku: "First day of spring, I keep thinking about the end of autumn." Poet Garrett Lansing now adds his ode to spring. It's called Hands That Melt Like Snow.
Do we hope much? Is that sentencing a river there in spring? Or isn't it that answering is green? Confusion is a gramercy where my sister Clarity is singing. Let me ring that, she says, let me ring in the grass. It is us, it is ours, over us, like watered silk or rock. Silk and like is hoping through. Do we hope a grammary equal to our hut? Or isn't well the lapidaire the well that answering is goodly bad? So profusion makes a speed that in our constancy stands up. Dressed in green, dressed in blue, figures lap their circles in the dark, goodly bad or happily a sentiment. Ending now is licking like. Spring calls for swinging in the cool, a tilth, a milkmaid secretly. Her eyes, his eyes, the magnet so disposes, up and down, holding fans at midnight.
Poet Garrett Lansing with his take on spring. You can read the poem for yourself by going to our website at weekendamerica.org. He told us that that last line, holding fans at midnight, reminds him of the line, holding hands at midnight, in the Gershwin tune, Nice Work If You Can Get It. Gershwin's song is all about how love is our most worthy pursuit, a perfect nod to spring fever and romance.
Holding hands at midnight, 'neath a starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
This spring weekend in the Midwest will include more unwelcome rain tomorrow. Here's more about this weekend's weather and activities with John Moe.
Sunny and 82 in Maui, Hawaii. Honestly, I don't know why I even bother looking up weather in Hawaii. It's never not sunny in 82. Kids are at Sleep with Sharks, an informational sleepover near the shark tank at Maui Ocean Center. Sharks call it the annual almost but not quite able to eat the children sleepover. Spring is on the way, flowers are in bloom, birds returning from the south, but Wakefield, Michigan is holding on to winter. 40 degrees at the Slush Cup, skiers go downhill, then cross, or don't quite cross, a no longer frozen pond, winning awards for best trick and best crash. Finally, someone has combined the three pastimes of skiing, swimming, and hypothermia. Is Jell-O a fruit, a vegetable, a meat? Correct answer, art supply. At least in Eugene, Oregon, which has rain in 49 at the Jell-O Art Show. The theme this year, Jell-O-topia, which I guess means entire cities built of Jell-O. I gotta think the transportation system would be tricky. And don't get me started about those Jell-O sewers. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
If you're spring cleaning this weekend, don't throw away those old letters until you listen to our next story on Weekend America. It's Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. If you're feeling ambitious this weekend, maybe you want to take on a big project, something like tackling all that junk in the basement or cleaning out the garage. That's what Weekend America senior reporter John Moe had to do recently. He was moving from Seattle to St. Paul, Minnesota, and that meant going through everything he owned and deciding what to keep and what to throw out. John is bringing us a series of stories called Moving Day, which are all about the sometimes thorny, sometimes emotional issues that go along with making a big move.
I have this box down in the basement. and it's the box. I'm sure you have one just like it, full of letters, photos, journal entries, term papers, birthday cards. Mine's a big Rubbermaid tote, 30-gallon size, pretty much me as told in paper from early childhood to about age 24. It must weigh 80 pounds, and I never open it. I never look at it. It's not like framed artwork or photo albums. I never get an urge to go down to the basement and read a birthday card from my mom from 1992. But moving means sorting through everything. Now, some of the stuff inside is quite lovely. A picture of me at 21 working at a summer camp. I'm happy, tan, hopeful, strutting toward the future. A lot of what's in here belongs in the why in the world did I keep this file? An envelope of hair from the barber visit that ended my hippie period. And this, Dear John, Ben would not be who he is if it weren't for you. Thank you for your dedication. Much love, Chris. Who's Ben? Who's Chris? Then there's the hard stuff. A postcard from my brother in 1987. He says he's sorry he didn't get to say goodbye before he left. I don't know what he's referring to. It was written 20 years before he died, suddenly. There are angry letters from friends I treated badly, telling me how much I hurt them. I saved them all, locked them away. I never read them. That can't be healthy, can it? Also in the box, stuff so horrible, it's funny. This in a note from a very ex-girlfriend. Your problem is you're way too needy, John, and it's not just me who feels that way. I've talked to people we both know, and we all agree that you're needy. Maybe I should call and see if she likes me any better now. There's a world of stuff in here, and after spending some time with it, I want to set it on fire. All of it. Oh, how can you say that? That's your past. Those are memories. That box is who you are. No, that box is who I was. Like when I was 10, I was a huge football fan. Football defined me, and I hoarded football trading cards. To this day, I have this one card, Chris Barr, kicker, Cincinnati Bengals. I reached Barr at his home in Bullsburg, Pennsylvania, and I asked him if I should keep the card.
Should you keep it? For what reason?
Well, because I've always kept it. I've had it since 1978.
Then I'd hang on to your cards.
Do you have that card of yourself?
Yes, I do. I have them all, actually, somewhere along the way. I know I have a helmet, a jersey. You know, I've moved, and they get into boxes and never go anywhere. Like I said, I've never really put anything out.
Maybe he should put it out. It's paper, dead trees. My box is dead weight, a corpse of memories that I have to ship or load onto a truck and then haul into my new basement in my new city where it will spend even more years never being looked at. I'd rather destroy it. The things that mattered are already memories. This is excess baggage. And I'm moving. I'm trying to start anew. The new me waking up in the new city wouldn't have to bear this weight. Thing is, I can't bring myself to do it. The stuff has a hold on me. Wanna chuck it? Can't. I'm held captive by ghosts. Eric Larson is in my box. He was the editor of my high school newspaper. I have numerous editions. They feature the worst writing I've ever done, and they trigger agonizing high school flashbacks. Eric was a journalism star in high school. Not long after graduating, he started selling insurance.
Oh my goodness. I'm almost ashamed or embarrassed to admit I've probably got at least a couple of dozen. I probably have every issue. They're in some of these Rubbermaid containers in the garage, neatly or cleverly or subconsciously positioned next to my wine cabinets, refrigerators. So as I go out occasionally on the weekend to grab a nice bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon or what have you to bring in a decant, I'll see the box there, and I will from time to time take a stroll down memory lane.
Eric's made peace with his box. He's made peace with himself. I guess I'm a little different than that. I don't wish to give up the people I love and the memories I cherish, but I'm willing to sacrifice all the papers, the evidence, the reminders, the senior prom tickets, the better-than-expected report card, the desperate resume from a period of total unemployment in order to achieve a kind of psychic lightness. I talk to lots of people from my box. Every one of them has a box of their own, or several. Some of them had entire storage lockers of boxes, and they spend hundreds of dollars a year to store them. Everyone wishes they could throw stuff out. No one has. But one night, after a long, emotionally exhausting session, sifting through my box with the pressure of moving day weighing on me, I found my nerve. I carried the box to the carport, placing it next to the garbage cans to await the garbage truck. I have never felt so free. I can move to St. Paul and be only who I wanted to be, not who I used to be. But before the garbage truck came, I went out to the carport, picked up the box, and carried it back in. And when the moving truck to St. Paul came, I put the stupid box on board. In Seattle, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
John has pulled some of the more obtuse and inscrutable items from his box and posted photos of them up at weekendamerica.org. See if you do any better than John at figuring out what the heck they are. Well, that's another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. We're so glad you've spent some time with us and hope you'll stick around. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Remember, you can download an enhanced free podcast of the entire program. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org. It's your weekend. Get out there and enjoy it.
News and financial information brought to you by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Weekend America's John Moe just moved cross-country in his minivan. You know how John Steinbeck told of travels with Charlie? John Moe has travels with Fuzzy, the hamster.
You know, we got a little over 100 miles to Billings. I think we'll stop there for the night, and then maybe you can go in your ball around the room. Hey, that's my microphone.
Seeing America through little bitty beady hamster eyes. Next time.